College Football and What We Can Do to Stop It, and it's published by Simon & Schuster. In the introduction to the book, he explains that over time, everything that he knew about college football finally got to him. It finally got to be too much. And he explains that as he thought about the ways in which college football abused and used the players, he writes, a phrase kept recurring, child abuse. Football athletes are just kids going off to college to play ball. They're like my kids, who seem so vulnerable, whom I want to protect from the ugliness of the world more than anything else, but who always seem to end up in the hands of other people, being taught lessons I don't believe in and receiving pain they do not need to receive. He goes on to write, what is happening to our college football players? Bad things are happening to them and to all of us, to fans, to students, to the fabric of the United States. Myths are being perpetrated in college football. People are lying in college football. Blind, malicious people are protecting their butts at a tremendous psychic and societal cost. Something is so wrong here that I don't think I can go on writing about the games and scores and strategies of the game when I know that the game is out of control, rotten from the foundation up. He resolved to do two things with what he knew and with his feelings. One of them was to write this book, and the other, he says, is to stop writing about college football. Mr. Tallender was an all-Big Ten cornerback at Northwestern University and a draft choice of the Kansas City Chiefs. He's the author of another book, Heaven is a Playground, which was republished in 1988 as a fireside sports classic, and he now makes his home in Chicago. And he's joining us this morning by telephone as we talk with Rick Tallender. If you have questions, you can pick up the telephone and be a part of this conversation. The local number here is 333-9455. The toll-free line, which you may use no matter where you are, is 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Mr. Tallender, hello.
Hello.
Thanks very much for being with us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
I guess, you know, one of my reactions to the book, and it is a very powerful book. It says some very, very strong things. You certainly don't mince your words. I guess one of my reactions to the book is wondering not so much why you were upset, but why more people aren't as upset as you are.
I think it's pretty obvious when you have a large system like this that periodically shows itself in very glorious, pleasurable moments of competition, i.e. the games. What the average fan, what the average alum, what the average student knows and sees about college football is the game on Saturday. And this past Saturday, this is a perfect example. It was one of the most beautiful days throughout the Midwest that I can remember for that date in October. Wherever people were tailgating, it was probably wonderful. Wherever they were waving their banners was probably wonderful. The pageantry of the game transcends anything that may go on behind it. It's like watching a facade of a Hollywood set that looks beautiful, and you don't take the time, because you don't really want to go around behind and see that it's all just propped up with boards.
Yeah.
And so, you know, part of my dilemma, and I have quit writing about college football for Sports Illustrated. That was my sacrifice, my statement, and believe me, it was something I enjoyed doing. Part of the problem was that it's as though in the last few years, as I was covering the sport exclusively, as though I was dipped into this ugly cauldron of the real hypocrisy of the game, and I just couldn't hide from it. And it really started to reach a head last year at the Fiesta Bowl, Notre Dame playing West Virginia, and I almost froze up at my typewriter. I mean, I didn't know what the story was anymore. Do you write about the game, or do you write about what you see going on underneath the game?
Yeah. I guess it's, when you stop to think about it, it's full of contradictions, and maybe at the base of it, the major contradiction is that I suppose it becomes evident to somebody like you who really does know about the realities of college football. The major contradiction is that college football exists as it does within this setting of the college and the university, and that somehow it seems to be so in such opposition to what colleges and universities say they stand for. When you start thinking about it, you can't somehow believe that colleges would allow it to go on, and yet they do, and nobody really questions it very much. I mean, when a scandal comes along, when a player is involved in a crime, which happens with disturbing regularity, then maybe questions are asked, but those questions go away pretty quick, and nobody really does ask this big question: is why is it that this thing exists under the wings of higher education in the United States? That it just doesn't fit there. It doesn't belong.
Your question is perfectly well-directed and well-thought-out, because what I see my book being about is much about football. I see it being even more about education, and I don't just mean education classroom, that sort of thing. I mean the education of all of Americans, and particularly the development of our young people into those people who will lead us out of a time of trouble. I mean, we have environmental problems, we have population problems, we have weapons problems. We have problems in the world right now that have never existed in the history of mankind. And as we head into the 21st century, these are things we've got to resolve. And people say, well, what in the world does football have to do with that? Well, you brought up the point. By being justified and winked at and allowed and tolerated to continue to exist in this corrupt manner on our college campuses, those temples of higher learning, we are sending a message not only just to the football players and the fans, but to everybody, that the truth perhaps isn't really pursued at our universities as much as money is, and that power and the entertainment of the masses is more important than integrity and ethics. And I think if I could read from you just one quick sentence in my book that maybe sums up a lot of what the hypocrisy of the game is. People will say, well, college football is part of the fabric of the college life, that it's a necessary part of fall afternoons for the students, that they must have it. Well, one thing that I identify in my book is that the game doesn't really exist at all for the students, and I list a number of games that are played thousands of miles away from students from the campus, played in foreign countries, played during times when students aren't even in school, during the holidays, before school starts. At any rate, that's pretty much a myth that it exists for the students. This is the Terry Branstad, the governor of Iowa, addressing Hunter Rawlings, who the president at the University of Iowa, who came up with a proposal that he would keep freshmen from being eligible on the football team. A very modest proposal, in that it used to exist. When I played football in the early 70s, freshmen couldn't play. They were allowed to play only for economic reasons, because coaches and everybody got together and said, we need these kids, we need more players. So this is Branstad's proposal, or his response to this proposal by Rawlings to not have freshmen eligible. Terry Branstad argued against Rawlings' proposal and then flat out admitted that college football is not just a university function. Football, said the governor, is very important and significant at larger universities. It is also, he said, a source of entertainment, this is a quote, a source of entertainment for many people who never went to college themselves. And therein you have it. It's encapsulated right there. What college football has become is an entertainment vehicle, the same as the circus or any other TV production, that is there to entertain people who have nothing to do with the university. At the University of Iowa, for instance, the fans of the team, in a poll done by the Des Moines Register, proved that only 13% of those people had ever taken a single class at the University of Iowa. So if you have entertainment for the masses, if that is the role of football now, which it never, ever was designed to be, it started back in the 1800s by the students, for the students, run entirely by the students for their own entertainment. But if it now is an entertainment vehicle to go out there and entertain the masses and make money, then you got a big problem with ethics and hypocrisy when these kids are supposedly amateurs and supposedly students.
Yeah. Our guest this morning is Rick Tallender. He's a senior writer for Sports Illustrated magazine. He's the author of the book, The 100-Yard Lie, The Corruption of College Football and What We Can Do to Stop It. You have comments, questions for our guest, you can call. We do have one person we'll get to just here in a second. Our local number, 333-9455. Toll-free, anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. Let's bring this first caller into the conversation here on our toll-free line. Hello.
Good morning, Rick.
Good morning.
Dave.
Yeah.
I think your comments are very interesting. I've always said that college football and professional football as well, they've all abused their players. I've always said that if any other business ran their companies like the NFL does, the Justice Department would be on them in a flash saying you can't do that. And I think that there should, I think you're right, I think there should be a minor league or some sort of a training league for football players who come out of high school who know that they don't have any business in college and who know that all they're going to do is play football anyway. And they should be allowed to stay there for, I don't know, a year or 2 years or whatever, and then just bring them up into the pros instead of this sham by giving them scholarships to go to college, and you know darn well they're not supposed to be there. They don't have the grades for it. They haven't had the education. And they're exploiting a lot of these kids, a lot of whom are never going to see the NFL or the basketball leagues or whatever. And so I think not only should it be done for football, but maybe it should be done for basketball as well. Just have a minor league for them where they can play for 2 or 3 years and maybe get some professional coaching or coaching training. And then just have them go into the professional leagues if that's what they want to do. But I think to put them into college and to exploit them like that and then say to them, well, kid, you're going to go to the NFL and make a lot of money. Maybe he will and maybe he won't. The chances are he probably won't. It's just like I always say that you don't quit your job, draw all of your money out of the bank, and buy lottery tickets hoping to win the big lottery. If you win, you're in great shape, but if you don't win, you're in bad shape.
I'd like to say I agree. I think there are many people out there who basically agree with would agree with all the premises of my book. I don't see my book as being considered that radical a look at college football, except for the fact that there are tremendous forces that work to keep the status quo. I was attacked by Bo Schembechler, the Michigan coach, who read three paragraphs of my book, and he just went out of his mind. He called me, he said, Rick Tellinger is a loser, he's a malcontent, he always has been a loser, you don't want him on your team, you don't want him writing for your magazine. This is after reading three paragraphs. And, you know, that's okay, although I don't know what my football skills at age 40 have to do with anything. But the simple fact is that there are many people like Bo Schembechler, which there are.
Well, you know, the thing of it is, they said the same thing about the players when they came. Remember when some players had the guts to come out and say that there was a sort of subtle gentleman's agreement in the NFL that blacks weren't going to be allowed to play quarterback and that there were certain positions on the team that they were going to be steered to. There were certain coaches, oh, this isn't true, this guy's a loser, he's a malcontent, he's one of these hippies that marches around with long hair and protests the Vietnam War and blah, 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 blah. And you had Vince Lombardi screaming and you had Woody Hayes screaming and you had all of these guys that like to get up and bully their players around. You had them screaming that this was true, blah, blah, blah. And yet, you don't, how many of them do you see in the NFL?
This is true. Here, one of the most telling parts of my book, I believe, and the one that has gotten the most shaking of heads and wide-eyed looks from people who feel that they know everything about college football, is that through my investigation and delving into records and talking with people who are somewhat knowledgeable in the fundraising and alumni aspects of college football or of college sports, that big-time revenue-producing sport, and the caller is correct that it is football and basketball, do not make any money for the university. They make none. And, in fact, the only evidence of the studies, and there are about 50 of them, going back to the early 20s or 30s, is that the money and they do generate money. The money generated by those big-time sports basically seems to detract from the money given to the general fund of the university. And the thing you have to realize here, which most people don't understand, the athletic department has nothing to do with the university. The money that goes to the athletic department never goes to the university. And in fact, at the U of I, which is really bizarre, the athletic department, until recently, in the scandal with Neil Stoner, the athletic director, was run by an outside corporation whose sole function was to make money. And you can't imagine a better way for corruption to exist than to have an outside corporation running students, unpaid students, to make money.
I have two questions. Do you think that, one, all this emphasis on winning is what has caused a lot of this scandal? In other words, if a coach doesn't win, he's history. That's the one question. And the other question is, now I noticed that women's sports, especially girls' sports, are coming up. They're online and they're becoming more popular. Do you think we're going to see the same type of troubles in these sports as well?
Mm-hmm. Those are two very good questions. And let me tell you something else that I identified or that I examined in my book. And believe me, I did a lot of my own soul searching. And I don't want to be lumped just with the people who say all sport is bad, winning is bad, competition is bad. I'm an athlete to this day. I love sports. I love the thrill of, I'll go play basketball. If somebody calls me up right now and says, I've got a game in a half hour, I'll cut this interview short so I can get out there and play. I think that winning, if you examine it, is in truth the only reason to play sports. I mean, it is the main motivation. In fact, as I said in my book, it is hard to imagine a high-level sport of any type in which winning isn't the main motivation. If it isn't, then you have something like pro wrestling, or you have something like guys going out drinking beer and playing golf and hitting the ball from their golf cart and not really caring. But you honor your opponent by trying to win. I think that is the essence of competition, and that is a beautiful thing. Therefore, I am never in favor of de-emphasizing winning. I think that there are two, if I can be known for any one motto, it would be this, that the best thing about sports is winning. The second best thing is losing. I think the chance to compete is what it's all about. And you try to win, but if you don't win, I think you should be a good loser. Now, to address the other questions, does winning or attempting to win, does this corrupt sport and college sport and ultimately the lesser sports, women's sports and all the other non-revenue men's sports? And the answer is, as long as you have certain criteria, that is, these players must be amateurs and they must be students, then yes, it will corrupt ultimately, because those rules are the rules that will be taken advantage of. You think about college football, other than the criminal scandals, which there have been too many even for me to document in the last few years, the real problems have been, quote, under-the-table payments, which basically is a function of this outdated and unreasonable amateur code, quote, amateurs, which amateurs don't even exist in the Olympics anymore. Carl Lewis made over $1 million last year. He's an amateur. The other part is, if you have high-level sport and you have these players supposed to be students, then you have eligibility scams, i.e. the players such as those at Ronnie Harmon and Devin Mitchell at Iowa take courses, take no courses towards their degree and take bowling 1 and 2, archery, taekwondo, courses like that, year after year, or Paul Palmer at Temple flunks remedial reading 3 times and remains eligible. So you have the eligibility problem and you have the money problem, and those are the two things that will always be abused as long as high-level sports are associated with universities.
I want to get onto another caller I have waiting, and I hope the last caller will forgive me if I go on. I do want to, just for a moment, though, come back to a point you made, because I think it's an important one. Because as people talk about college football and talk about their feelings about how difficult it would be to make changes, the thing that will come up again and again is the money. They're going to say, well, you know, it just makes too much money. Nobody's going to want to attack that institution. And it's your contention that it may make a lot of money, but that doesn't go into the general coffers of the university. In most cases, it goes back into the program. It pays coaches' salaries. It pays stadium maintenance, whatever it is. And it certainly doesn't encourage alums to give money for scholarships for, computer whizzes or kids who are going to be English majors or anything like that. If that is true, if it's really true that football teams don't make money for the school, why is it then it seems so many school administrators and other people are so afraid to go near the programs or question the way they operate?
Isn't that a remarkable thing? I mean, you hit at the essence of the problem. You address the presidents. Do presidents run the universities? If they do, why don't they take control of these things? If you give me just a second, I'll try to explain this.
Sure.
And a lot of this stuff is very simple, but it's a very intricate web that has been spun that has allowed this thing to get this way. First of all, presidents, by and large, are busy with trying to run the university, trying to keep the people in the English department and the physics department happy. This football program, and let's just, I'm not going to bring in basketball, although basketball is very similar to football. This football program was established long time ago, at the turn of the century, when the universities first took over the athletic departments. And until the turn of the century, by and large, these football teams were run by the students. There was no faculty blessing, and there was certainly no administrative blessing. But the students started football as a response to the repression of the university life in general, which back in the 1700s and 1800s, colleges were almost all clerical. William and Mary, Yale, Princeton, Harvard, they were all run by the church. And therefore, pleasures of the flesh were heavily denied and were not allowed, not tolerated, no sporting events whatsoever. So to keep them going crazy, and back in the 1800s, early 1800s, students used to burn down their universities and beat up the headmasters and things like that because they would just go, they couldn't stand to sit all day in these classes. They developed football. Well, football started to make money as people started to want to see it. And once that was recognized, then the universities took control. And the juggernaut began way back in the early 1900s when Teddy Roosevelt was president, and it has continued. And it has gained more and more power, and the coaches have had more and more power and more say, and the athletic directors and the boosters. And everybody says, well, who are these boosters? The boosters are, by and large, wealthy businessmen who give a lot of money to the university in the form of money to the athletic department. And they quite often have the ear of the president. And the president does not want to rock the boat or change anything. You just go along with the system, the status quo. Now, he has all this ammunition to use against them. That is, as I pointed out in my book, that these programs don't make money for the universities. And if they don't make money for the universities, then why do you need something that is so blatantly corrupt and anti-intellectual on your campus? Well, they just tolerate it because they don't want to rock the boat, and quite often they have been elected by Board of Regents and Board of Governors who may be incredible sports fans. And I kind of trace this back. I know at the University of Miami of Ohio, one of the Board of Regents who elects the president is a guy who's a general manager of a pro basketball team. And during one game last season, he was part, although not a violent part, of a fight on the court and was fined $1,000 by the NBA. And as I state in my book, gee, I wonder if this guy really wants to win. Is this the kind of person you want to have control over your president? Ultimately, though, the presidents do have control of all this stuff. They may be martyrs if they try to change things, but the stuff that I unearthed about the funds not going to the university, I got a letter. I just got it today from the author of one of the main articles that came out of the Chronicle of Higher Learning, which goes around to administrators throughout America. And he said, "Thank you so much for publishing my work. I felt for a long time that I was writing in a vacuum. And if the presidents want to use my book as ammunition, then that would be wonderful." As I said, we send copies of this to every Division I college president in the hopes that he can say, look, you guys, look, you boosters, look, you athletic departments, look, you coaches, we don't need this. We don't have to have it. Let's set up a different system. Let's divorce these big-time football juggernauts from the universities, and everybody will be happy. And I think there's a way it can be done, and that's what I propose at the end of my book.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure we'll get a chance to talk about that, and I've got some other callers here I want to get to, and we'll do that in just a second. Our guest this morning in this first hour of Focus is Rick Tellender. He is a senior writer for Sports Illustrated magazine. He's the author of the book The 100-Yard Lie, a book very critical of college football. But as he says, he does make some suggestions for how things could be changed, and we'll talk about that. This morning we're talking with Rick Tellender. He writes for Sports Illustrated magazine. He is the author of the book, The 100-Yard Lie, The Corruption of College Football, and What We Can Do to Stop It. It's published by Simon & Schuster. Rick Tellender played football at Northwestern University. He was an all-Big Ten cornerback and was a draft choice of the Kansas City Chiefs. You have some questions on the topic or some comments to share with us. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. We'll go to here, caller on line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
First of all, I just want to say I read the article in Sports Illustrated last week, and I want to compliment you. I thought that was very good. And if anybody in the local community has any questions about whether what you say is true, they just need to look at the recent history here at the U of I. When you talk about what kind of lessons we teach, look at Neil Stoner and Mike White. Not only do you lie and cheat, but you're rewarded for it in big-time athletics. Also, the business about money coming to the university. A few years ago when the Big Ten cut us out of revenues, and everybody was all upset about that during the Dave Wilson affair, they had a special lottery for the football team to make up that money. You know, now we don't have special lotteries for the library or the engineering department, but we do for the football team. That seems kind of sad.
It's you brought up the interesting aspects of this. The coach, I think about Neil Stoner and I think about White. The unfortunate thing is the way the system is set up, a coach is only rewarded for winning. He can't afford to be an ethical, caring human being because he can graduate every one of his players, have them all be very sensitive, caring, driven, prolific and intelligent young men, Rhodes Scholars, what have you, and if his team goes 3-8, he will get fired. And, you know, I've addressed this. I've talked to Barry Switzer about this. He knows it. I mean, he ultimately did resign, but he got the most trouble, flack, in his career, the Oklahoma coach, not for the problems that he had with players, payoffs and the lack of ethical things going on there, the starting quarterback going to prison for selling cocaine to an FBI agent, another player shooting another one in the dorm. But actually, his biggest troubles came when his team went 8-4 mm-hmm. and 7-4-1 in consecutive seasons. Mm-hmm. That was something that the people just couldn't tolerate. Same thing with Neil Stoner. I know when he's in my book. When he resigned, finally, under pressure, he said, "Why is everybody so upset? I did what they wanted me to do. We made money, and that was what I'd been hired to do."
Well, I've lived in this community all my life, and I've been attached in one way or the other to the U of I most of that time, and he didn't do what I wanted him to do. And I don't think he did. If people would look at it and take a lot of the emotion out of it, they would realize that they're not doing what they want them to do. They're cheating, they're lying, they cut corners, and I think your term child abuse is perfect for what they do to those kids. It's terrible.
I see the damage raising its head later also. And you know what else? Here's the point that people don't bring up too often. The child abuse extends to the student body at large.
Sure.
If you go to that school, you're always winking and always saying, mm-hmm. those are just the football players. Of course they drive those fancy cars. Of course they're not real students. Of course they get their crimes covered up. Of course they get payments under the table. Mm-hmm. That's just the way the system is. That's how adults run the world.
Well, just look at the cutoff rate to get into this school for your grade point is fairly high. I don't know what it is now, but they turn away a lot of very good students. But a football or basketball player doesn't even have to have a C average to get into this school. And that's wrong.
Mm-hmm. I tell you, you addressed another point that I find particularly critical. At more and more at the higher levels, college basketball and college football are played by black athletes.
Sure.
I have followed this trend, and I'm not even talking about, I'm not going to get into any of the wares or the or whys or any of that stuff that has been debated for years, but the simple fact is blacks now dominate at the highest levels on the All-America teams, on the All-Pro teams, on the USA Today's All-High School All-America team last year. There were, I have it in my book, but I believe there were 17 out of the 26 players were black. Now, more and more of those players come from troubled homes, come from inner cities, come from places where they have not had the advantage that a white suburban athlete might have or a white rural athlete might have. And then they come to a university, into a university setting, which the national average at the largest universities is approximately 3 to 4% blacks out of the total enrollment. Mm-hmm. They're thrust into a foreign environment, and they're basically used by a white audience to entertain them.
Right.
And if you could just see the disoriented attitudes of these players, to see them try to adapt to this environment at the same time that they're supposed to be amateurs, and also they may have tremendous learning disabilities simply because of the public school environment that they came from, it is child abuse.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't have any more to say, but I think you show a lot of courage and giving up your position or whatever it was Sports Illustrated to say what you did. More people ought to do it, including the college presidents that profit from this, I think.
Well, thank you.
If
I could hope anything, it would be, as I said, that people could use this book, and if my minimal sacrifice can help, then we'll all benefit.
Okay, I appreciate the call. Let's go on here to talk with somebody else. We'll go to our toll-free line. Hello.
Yes, I've also read the article in Sports Illustrated. It was very good and heartening to see it. A lot of it, as the author knows, is a rehash of past history and just digging up more about this. There are two issues that I'd like to raise, and they both have to do with the coaches. What is the resistance of athletic coaches wanting their graduation rates to be published? This is a university, isn't it? I mean, aren't youngsters supposed to graduate?
That is one of the more bizarre, if not most bizarre, reluctances that I've ever seen, and I'll explain what he's talking about now. Senator Bill Bradley and Representative Tom McMillan have asked to federally pass a federal bill. It's called the Right to Know Bill, which will do nothing more than force universities to publish the graduation rate for their athletes broken down by sport. And you would say, as this gentleman says, and as I say, and as any sane person says, well, why in the hell wouldn't they do that anyway? It is a university. I mean, just tell who graduated. What's the big deal? The NCAA, in its power, and if you ever have heard the term power corrupts, this is it. They are not aware that they're corrupt. They think that they're doing good. They think that they're doing right. But they think that there are reasons. They try to come up with these lame reasons why they shouldn't publish the graduation rates. And I was on a panel called Ethics in Sport at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas a couple months ago, and Tom McMillan was there, and so was Al Witte from the president of the NCAA, and we talked about this, and it was bizarre doublespeak. I mean, if you don't, there is no justification for it, and yet they will cling, the NCAA will cling to the status quo, as apparently we all do. It's one of our, humans have this unfortunate desire to keep things always as they are, to never change, whether it's for good or evil, to never change. They just like the stasis. And the NCAA just doesn't want to do it for no apparent reason. And here's the real sad thing. If you don't make correct change yourself while you have the power, then the tragedy is the federal government or a groundswell movement of people will make you do it. And then it's much, much worse, much more. I see this bill, once it's passed, it'll be just a mountain of bureaucracy and forms and papers and duplicates and this and that. It'd be so much easier if the NCAA would heal itself. But unfortunately, it has no desire to.
And did you recall last year when all this talk was going on and Dick Vitale and his crew of public relations were really blasting schools for firing coaches who didn't win, and they thought what a travesty it was and how it wasn't lending itself to the real idea of athletics and whatever. And then I believe there were a group of coaches who were wanting to start a fund to help fired coaches who were making hundreds of thousands of dollars somehow get over the rough times when they didn't have a job.
Yes, and the way they wanted to do this was by adding another game to the schedule.
That's correct.
And in sense, getting more, extracting more money from their free labor, which is the students. Here's something I think, that the listeners may not know, and I find this kind of fascinating. Most college coaches have written into their contract, many of them do anyway, a la Jackie Sherrill's wonderful contract at Texas A&M, that if they go to a postseason bowl game, if the team is that successful, that the coach gets a huge bonus. And according to Sherrill's contract, it said for the extra amount of time and effort and sacrifice that he will put in to coach this team to that bowl game. Now, what do the players get? They get an extra month or so of practice. They get the chance to be injured. They get the chance to miss vacation with their friends. I'll tell you from personal experience, I was at Northwestern, believe it or not, we actually weren't that bad. We finished second in the Big Ten, and there was a point at which we were getting ready to play Ohio State, and we had a chance to win the Big Ten if we'd won the game, and we were headed halftime. We ended up losing, but not by too much. At any rate, some of the players would sit around and we'd say, you know, if we win this, if we win the Big Ten, we go to the Rose Bowl. What do you guys think? And we'd say, well, you know, of course we want to win. We want to win the Big Ten. But going to the Rose Bowl, you know, I haven't been home in so long. I'd like to go home for Thanksgiving. I'm so sick of practice. My body is so sore. It didn't mean much to us. I mean, and I was just talking with my buddies who I played football with just this last week, and we all still, almost to the man, recall that and still feel the same way. That reward is a reward for the coaches, for the athletic department, for the fans, for all the viewers. But for the players, it means a lot more work.
Hmm. We're moving into our last 10 minutes. I have a couple of other callers. We'll get right on, and we'll try to accommodate as many people as we can. Let me just tell you once again, if you've tuned in, that our guest is Rick Tellender. He's a writer for Sports Illustrated magazine, and he is the author of the book The 100-Yard Lie, which has just come out. It's a book that's very critical of college football. Let me just take a minute, and I hope these callers will bear with us, because I want to make sure that I give you the opportunity to talk a little bit about your thoughts for change. It seems that the problem, maybe the bottom line problem we have with college football, is that it is a de facto farm system for the NFL. And it seems that the suggestion you're making is that what we do is we set up a real, you know, farm system, something that would be the equivalent of the minor leagues in baseball. Colleges could be involved if they wanted to, but that we could, and that those players should be paid, and we should run it a little bit more like the NFL. And let's be honest and say we're paying these guys to play football, and if colleges want to also have a football team, well, they can't have both kinds of team. They could have one of those kind of team, but if they also wanted to just play football, they could do that, but that those players, you know, they couldn't charge admission to the game, they couldn't be there on scholarship, it couldn't be the kind of big deal that it is now.
Yeah, exactly, that's it. If we analyze this the way I did, thinking about this for so long, what you find is that what we watch at big-time universities and the big-time football program is basically age group professional football. It is a level of football that is identical to what is played in the pros in the NFL. The only difference is it's governed by age group, more or less. The players are age 18 to 22, possibly 23. And that is the only criteria that separates it from the NFL. The sham aspect of being a student, which clearly is almost impossible because of the amount of time put in, and people have to realize that quite often players are asked to put in 40 hours a week on football. I'm including travel, I'm including training, training table, film, study, practice, and then, of course, you know, the game itself, and quite often you'll travel a great distance. So it makes it virtually impossible to be a student. So they are unpaid professionals, if you will. And people say, well, they get a scholarship. Yes, but many of these athletes don't want scholarships. They don't want to be in college. Deion Sanders from Florida State told me last year, point blank, no, I don't want to be in college. I don't want to be here, but I have to be if I want to play in the NFL. So that being the case, we will address what it is that makes college football pleasurable. It's the highest level of football at that age group. So I propose the age group professional football league.
age 18 to 22, players who want to play at the highest level. They will play on these teams which will substitute and not compete with or anything else. They will substitute for the highest level Division I football teams, maybe 80 to 100 schools. Therefore, they will have the same stadium in place. They can be, it can be the Fighting Illini. It won't be the University of Illinois Fighting Illini, but it'll be the Illinois Fighting Illini. They use the same, they use Zupke Field. Everything is the same, except they don't have to be students. So you get rid of that fraud of academia. Then you pay them. And I've had a number of letters, some even from people such as Donald Dixon, who was the founder of the USFL, who has already proposed a plan and has a pay scale set up so that these athletes then, if they want to go to the NFL, even if they don't make it, they will have earned money while they were attempting to get there. On the other hand, in colleges, real colleges that want to have real college football, as you said, there will be no scholarships, there will be a limited season, there will be no preseason practice, no spring practice, no freshman eligibility. The coaches may not profit by any shoe contracts, any TV revenue, any radio revenue. The gates are always open to all. Students must be students. There'd be no fiddling with their economic or their academic records at all. They'll have the same entrance requirements as all the other students. And basically, it will be an acknowledgement by the players and everyone else that this is college football. It's a lower level. It's not nearly as good as the age group professional league, but it's real students. You know, it's the guys that live down the hall from you in the dorm. And if they want to be real good and they want to take that shot at the big time, just as I said in my book, it's like if you want to be in a rock and roll band and you want to make it big time and you're 18 or 19, well, then you take your chance. You go out on the road with your band and you live in flop houses and you drive around and you don't have much money, but you take that risk and you take that chance. And if you don't make it to the top, well, then you can go back and get your education later. And that's exactly what we'd have. And it would be, I don't see who wouldn't be happy about it. It would get rid of all the fraud.
Well, I want to take a few more callers here and try to get some of these folks in before we have to finish. Let's go here to line one. Hello.
Yes. Hello.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I just want to thank you very much. I'm going to go out exactly today, call long distance to Crocs and Brentano's and order your book because your talk, your discussion is a breath of fresh air. I live out in the country. I taught 12 years, and I'll talk real quickly, in the inner city, and I know exactly what you mean about them abusing and using the black athlete, especially in high school. But before you're talking about college, you've got a real serious problem in the rural areas. I recruit for my son's college and another college, and I've gone to a lot of these high school conferences where we recruit students for college, and I had one student, advisor from one of the schools near Springfield say to me that, well, the rural areas, really, the high school football teams and the pro teams, this is the entertainment for America. It's not only a problem with the inner city athletes, black athletes, but with the students in the rural high schools, because there are not enough students in high school, and some of them are really harassed by the coaches if they go out for any other extracurricular activities. Then when I come in and talk to parents and students and tell them, well, look how our students are performing mathematically and in science and in the humanities compared to the other students, you can't reason with them because this is their entertainment. So it's not only, it's a serious problem not only in college, not only in the inner cities, but it's a serious problem all across the United States, going down to elementary and junior high, where these students really are forced not to engage in any other activity with football. So how do you educate America about this?
You brought up two very interesting points, both of which I address in my book. And one is the concept of being a man, of being a full-formed person who has the self-identity of a man, being macho, if you will. How can a young man, an adolescent, address those changing feelings that he has, and know that he does not have to sublimate his learning,
his desire to be a sensitive person, a person who cares about things other than just beating somebody up. It's a very difficult thing because football is first becomes a mania for kids in high school, and quite often you're very, very insecure about your own sense of self-worth. And it's very easy for these coaches, just as Bo Schembechler attacked me. Here I am, 40 years old. What did he call me? He called me a loser. I'm surprised he didn't call me a quitter, a coward, a guy that he said, you don't want me on your team. That's how coaches typically, and Bo probably isn't even aware how he fell directly into that routine. They attack your sense of self-worth and your sense of manhood. And you do that to young high school-aged boys, it is very, very difficult for them to argue with that, particularly if they don't get encouragement and enforcement from their peer group and their parents saying, look, you don't have to be a middle linebacker to be a man. The other thing you brought up about education and maybe not being able to do both at the same time, I think the demands put on players for this entertainment, again, the woman brought up the word entertainment, high school kids entertaining people out on the on the Friday nights or Saturday afternoon games. That's scary. We as adults have it in our power, and we must recognize what we're doing. We can't live vicariously through our youth. And I'm not against games. I'm not even against football. But there are times when we got to step back and say, whoa, what are we doing?
I want to squeeze just one more person in here. Let's go to line two. I'll have to ask you to be brief, though, if you can.
Okay. First of all, calling a college a child abuse for college students, I think, is wrong. These people are old enough to be responsible for their own decisions. I can accept the fact that coaches tend to drive people and can be abusive, but I don't think it's right to pick out just a few just for. I know that it's a prevailing thing about this entertainment, but if you take out entertainment, if there's something wrong with entertainment, we got to get rid of movies, got to get rid of rock and roll, because a lot of these people, they love it. The people that are on the field, they love to be the entertainer.
I'm sorry to have to jump in on you, but I got to because we don't have more than about a minute or so. I want to get Rick Tellender to just reply to that. That idea that these aren't kids, they're young men and they know what they're doing and they can take care of themselves.
Well, two things. He said that we get rid of all entertainment. No, we don't. I'm just saying, rock and roll movies. I love both of them, but those people who do that entertaining get paid for it, and they get paid right up front because it's work, and that's what these athletes are doing is work, regardless of how much they may enjoy the games themselves. The other thing about the athletes being adults, I think that as long as you are still a teenager or even, say, 20 years old, and as long as you're part of the educational system, which you have to feel knows more than you do, and it is telling you something that is incorrect, that is hypocritical, then I think that you don't have the power to disagree with that. And that it is a form of child abuse. Maybe you could call it young adult abuse, but I think it's something that ultimately all of us will sense the damage from. And I'm not saying the game itself is so evil. All I'm asking for, if people remember what my proposal is, we'll basically have the same entertainment vehicle that everybody loves, and the players will still be able to go out there and knock heads. It just will be upfront, above board, and it won't be hypocritical and it won't be unethical.
Okay, we got to leave it at that. Thanks very much for talking with us. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Our guest is Rick Tellender. If you're interested in reading more on the topic, you can look for his book, The 100-Yard Lie. It's published by Simon & Schuster. We'll take a break. When we continue with Focus, we'll be speaking with novelist Alan Gurganis. His book is Oldest Living Confederate Widow Tells All.